Namaste, good morning everyone. I'd like to read out something which the Sufi master affectionately called as Bhai Sahib says about satsang. Somebody came to him and said, "You have given me so much." And he replied, "Here is nobody to give and nobody to receive. The very fact that you came to me makes you entitled to get something. But it is not always the intention of the Almighty that help should be given 100%. Some help is given, then people come back for more. And the rest is done by and by in satsang. The iron is put into the magnetic field till it becomes a magnet. If it is taken out too quickly, it loses its magnetic property and becomes iron again. So it is with satsang. Time is needed. Remember, God is in all men, but all men are not in God." This is the value of satsang. And time is needed because of this baggage of conditioning that we have been carrying since birth, practically, and all our beliefs, which were rather thrust upon us, beginning with our parents' beliefs. There is one mail I received yesterday, just yesterday, by a very sincere seeker of truth, which I would like to discuss with you all. Go a bit deep into it. But before that, I just wanted to touch upon one incident that happened yesterday. Someone brought their dog home to our home. It was his birthday. So I said, "All right, bring the dog." 6 months old. 6 month birthday. A golden retriever. The dog was very happy and was wagging its long tail left and right, left and right. And sure enough, it knocked off one photo frame which fell to the ground. And the immediate reaction of the dog owner was to admonish the dog in a nice way, of course, because the dog is like a child. And I said, "Look, the dog doesn't even know that its tail is being wagged. It's not doing it deliberately. Neither does it know it knocked off an object in manifestation. And so shouting at it is not going to help. It's going to get more confused. What did I do wrong?" An object fell, the glass broke, and it will get repaired in the duration of time. This poor fellow has no clue what happened. All he knows is he was happy, and then he has to suffer the consequences of actions that are not his. Isn't that the absurdity of life? More so when we blame people. This is the beauty of this teaching. It brings it to light in daily living incidents and instances. Not through mystical experiences, through mundane experiences. Now, more importantly, this does not mean that a similar situation in future may not elicit a response. As Nisargadatta Maharaj said when he was asked, if I come at you with a knife right now, what will you do? And his answer was, I don't know. I don't know what arises in the moment spontaneously, without any preconceived notions, ideas, and beliefs. But what we tend to do is we set up an ideal. This is how I should be and how I should behave. That is where we fall. Supposing the same incident with the dog happens another day, let's say, and it's a rough day. Let's say one's blood pressure is up. Let's say one receives some bad news in the course of the day. And one is a bit, so to speak, wired up. A different reaction may happen. Irritability may arise. Spontaneous anger may arise. Who knows? But even if that happens, that is immediately washed away. It is in the moment. That is what happens. Neither is the dog judged, nor is the dog owner judged, nor is the event judged, and nor is me judged. That is the gift of the teaching. The end result is peace of mind. Someone shared with me a very beautiful quotation of Siddharameshwar Maharaj. That is what I love about this lineage. It is such a simple teaching, this parampara. Siddharameshwar Maharaj was Nisargadatta Maharaj's guru. Parampara, as Bhai Sahib says, the literal translation is lineage, the line of masters, but it actually means heart to heart. It is the teaching that has been transferred through the generations, you may say, heart to heart. Consciousness to consciousness, not the physical heart. Parampara. To be without anxiety is the highest sadhana. That is it. Okay. I have been practicing the I am meditation since the last 4 to 5 years. And the breakthrough did occur in between. I have also received Diksha Mantra. I have got an understanding of your key messages from meditations and the live sessions. The central point for me is that always watching the mind go about its desired thought is not possible. Definitely not. And it must be so tiring to always watch the mind go after the thoughts. Then there's what else time is left? What can one do in daily living if one is going to do this all the time? There are several impressions from innumerable lifetimes which tend to drive the mind outwards via the senses. It is very difficult to simply watch with patience every such impression when it arises from memory. Some are easy to handle as they are weak enough to be gone, but the few main ones on sense pleasures are really difficult to dissolve. I feel vexed having satisfied each of these strong ones many times and also having experienced the pain that follows it. It is at this point I feel very defeated and lost. Neither am I able to watch from the true nature with patience, nor am I able to wholeheartedly chase the desire due to the pain and misery that follows it. Before I go on, you see, this is what happens. We follow meditation, mindfulness, spiritual teachings with the hope that they give us peace of mind, but in this case and in many cases, it creates more anxiety. This is how the ego is wired. Anxiety and the ego are hand in glove. The ego loves anxiety and now has created anxiety out of the spiritual practice. And this happens because the ego thinks it is in control. Can you imagine? Already one is anxious in life, and on top of that, one's spiritual practice is making one anxious about the spiritual practice. Now the ego has something to do, which is a spiritual practice, and it thinks it is in control of guiding the spiritual practice and gets frustrated because it realizes that it is not in its control. And therefore, if a spiritual practice is not giving one peace, one has to look at it. Many times have I seen this. I have got emails from yoga teachers, from people following different modalities, and they are anxious about the practice. Would God want you to be more anxious? So one has to be gentle on oneself. Anxiety can arise in the initial stages of a spiritual practice. For example, I say to someone, you are not the doer of your actions and nor is the other. And one explains it. Genetics, conditioning, etc., etc. And you feel, wow. There seems to be some truth in this new way of looking. Yet anxiety may arise because the beliefs of the ego are challenged. How can it be? Is it possible? And anxiety can arise because the ego is shaken up by the truth. And by, when the ego starts seeing through this new way of being, the anxiety lessens and lessens and lessens. That is part of the process of deliverance. But if there is a practice one is undertaking, be it meditation or whatever it is, and it's creating and building up anxiety without a smidgen of peace of mind, without saying, hey, my God, my relationships are actually lighter. My relationship with myself is lighter compared with a year ago. Then one has to look at that practice. I had read in a book called Bringers of the Dawn that human beings tend to get lost in the processing of their dramas. Human beings tend to get lost in the process of processing. That is what we do. We think too much, overthink situations, and create a mess out of them. It is like Medusa's head, you know. As Rameshji had said in one of his books, are we going to snip at each snake which is coming out of Medusa's head, which was full of snakes, one by one? Or a teaching comes and chops off Medusa's head once and for all. You keep snipping off one snake of the thinking mind, the others will sprout up. But something comes along and says, hey, look, all there is consciousness. Nobody is truly the doer of their actions. Whatever happens is God's will. Act as if you have free will, knowing that the results are never in your control. When this kind of understanding gets imbibed, Medusa's head is chopped once and for all. You see, Medusa's gift was anyone who saw her would turn to stone. So nobody could really kill her because they tried approaching her and they would turn to stone. And then came along Perseus to kill her. And how did he do it? He polished his shield to such a degree that he approached Medusa without looking at her, by just looking at her reflection in his shield. By and by, he fought the reflection. That was his skill. He was so skilled. Till he found himself in a position where he could turn around and chop the head off. The world is a reflection within consciousness. We think that if a mirror is placed in front of us, we see our reflection. Now, if the mirror is removed, we feel, oh, now I don't see my reflection. No, you see it. The mirror is not there. Everything is a reflection within consciousness. Whatever you see is arising within your consciousness. The others, the so-called others, are the mirrors reflecting it back to us. Life is short. It's time to allow the teaching to do its job. The understanding, the wisdom of the ancients. There was a master who kept telling everyone, life is short, life is short, wake up. And he lived to be 107 years old. So to continue this, it is also clear to an extent that these memories and impressions of pleasure are not that of the experience itself, for pleasure is not an object in itself. Most certainly, this is a very valid point. It is the feeling we get which we are addicted to. If we have a glass of wine or whatever the pleasure may be, it is what arises within us. And that is just the trigger to make that feeling arise within us. So it is not the object itself. It is very painful, suffocating at these peak moments in life. I seriously don't know what to do. I seriously don't know what to do. Stop doing this. Stop looking at each and every thought, seeing the impressions. Forget all this. Just stop it. There was a dog that was not responding to its name being called. So they took the dog to the psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist told the dog's owners to leave the room and asked the dog, "Why are you not responding to your name being called?" And the dog said, "I'm so confused. Sometimes they call me stop that, and sometimes they call me get back here. I seriously don't know what to do. I want to overcome them, but I can feel my own limitation in capacity to let go of the strong impressions." You see, the beauty of this question is all the answers are offered within the question itself. And this is for all of us to understand this. Our answers are within the question. If you seriously don't know what to do, allow it to do its job. I can feel my own limitation and capacity to let go of the strong impressions, and without clearing all impressions, habits, and tendencies, true realization has not occurred, as Nisargadatta Maharaj has said. Also, Sri Anandmayima has said that once real sadhana begins, it is impossible to stop it. And that, my friend, is because you don't begin the real sadhana. Life puts you on the path. Your suffering, your sorrows, whatever it may be, creates this turning within. This is an act of God. It is the grace of God. If one finds oneself questioning life, what is happening? Why is this happening? That was not started by you. That was started by events that transpired in your life which were not in your control. That is why Bhai Sahib said, if you follow truth, truth will follow you. I would say it will hound you. As Bhagwan said, your head is already in the tiger's mouth. I feel lost, confused at the crossroads of life here. There is a strong feeling that without an external, powerful, realized master, it's simply impossible for me to overcome this limitation of objective experiences, impressions, and pleasures. I feel very defeated and sad. What can I do here? To bring synchronization between the internal and the external, and to truly embark on the who am I question. It's at one level, the earnestness is so deeply moving, because this is someone who is viewing life with such sincerity. But is losing out on the simple joy of being, which is nothing but the absence of the thinking mind of the ego. If you have no fears of the future and no regrets of the past, and your mind is working in pristine purity, available for whatever happens the next moment, then one is being in the I am. Without really doing anything. If in that mind there is no hatred, malice, blame, condemnation, jealousy, envy, pride, arrogance, if none of that data is there, you are being in the I am. If you view life as a series of happenings, rather than a series of happenings happening to me, you are in the I am. It is daily living that establishes one in the I am. Reflection on it, contemplation on it, understanding it. And so my suggestion here would be, in this case, is to let go a bit, relax the reins a bit. Don't try too hard. See life in all its glory, the pleasures and pains. Don't try to analyze the pleasures away, chasing the pleasures. Why is one chasing pleasures, although one knows it leads to pain? You know it. Can you help not chasing them? It's even that happens. Why? Conditioning. Pleasure after pleasure after pleasure. At some point it will stop. At which point will it stop? God knows. All we can do is try. Someone came to Bhai Sahib and asked him, this practice, that practice, dhyana, this, that. He said, forget this all. One practice. Just try not to hurt the feelings of others. That's it. That practice. The problem is that the ego wants to storm the kingdom of heaven. I achieved it. I did it. All right. If anyone would like to share anything, then they are welcome to, or ask a question. The only sincere request I have is, enjoy the spiritual journey if you can. It's a journey of discovery, of unfoldment, of wonder. Punish yourself. Thank the Almighty if you have a more relaxed day once in a while, as far as the mind is concerned. That, oh my God, I saw this person, this event, this situation in a different light today. That is the gift. Yes, Usha.
Yeah, namaste, Gautamji.
Oh, namaste, welcome back.
Gautamji, can you please explain, just now you said that the God is in all beings, but all beings are not in God.
Yes, those are the words of the Sufi master Bhai Sahib. And what he meant was that if we blame and condemn and judge people for having done something without understanding that they are acting based on their nature, their genetics, and their conditioning, which God created, then in that sense, we are disconnected from the source, when that is how we view the people in our lives. That is what he was pointing at. When I see the entire picture, when I see that the person upsetting me is doing so not as a deliberate act, even if it may seem that way, when I understand this person's thought processes are shaped by the way life conditioned them, their parents, what significant events happened in their lives, I don't know. The geographical area they were in, the religion they were born to, and so on and so forth. Then I no longer condemn them for saying something or doing something. I view them objectively as an instrument of God, just as I am, just as God created me. based on my genetics, my nature, my conditioning. So we are no longer battling with individuals in our lives. When we have this realization, then we are in God. We are no longer separated. That is what is implied in the statement. God is in all beings, but all beings are not in God.
Okay. Thank you.
I mean, you see, the Sufi path also is a path of surrender to the divine will. It is the same thing. Only some of them were pretty hard taskmasters. This, I find, is a gentler way for the teaching to be delivered.
Thank you.
Okay?
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Swet. Is that Swet or Sweta?
Yes, Shwet, Shwet.
Shwet, Shwet. Okay. Hi, Shwet.
Hi. No, my question was, if is everything predestined, then me getting self-realization, is that also predestined?
Yes.
So there is no control I have?
You do. You can do all that you think and feel that you should do in order to get it.
And how to make difficult life choices?
Sorry?
How to make difficult life choices?
How to make difficult life choices? Or you mean, do you mean to say that if you have to take a decision that is difficult, how to take it?
No, important choices. Like one should get married or not.
That is a difficult choice. Well, Shwet, this teaching says that you have to do that which you think and feel you should do. Why is buddhi given? But go ahead and do it knowing two things. One is the result will never be in your control. If you think you can control the outcome of the marriage, it ain't gonna happen. Two, and more importantly, the decision you take is based on your own genetics and your conditioning. Right. How your parents are in their married life, how you have been brought up, the school you have gone to, the friends you have, they have all shaped you. And it is that which enables you to take a decision. So is it truly your decision? Or is it God who has conspired to make a decision happen through you? So what happens is, all Shwet gets is this understanding of life that, you know, I have to make a decision. Do I marry this girl or not? But now I know two things. I cannot control the outcome. Both our intentions may be great, but we don't know how it will turn out. Two, I don't judge myself and hold myself responsible for taking a wrong decision if something goes wrong with the marriage. I don't beat myself up.
So my question was, should I get married at all or remain single?
That is a decision for you to take.
Can that be an obstacle to my progress, spiritual progress? Marriage?
It's up to you to think whether it will be. There are two kinds of gurus and teachers, the householder gurus who are married and have children, and those who are the monks who are celibate, who are single. Now, my lineage was a householder guru lineage. They were family men, they had children. And I think one learns tremendously through relationships and karmic relationships. But how are you wired up? Are you someone who in your heart wants that or does not want that? It's a very personal thing. If you keep aside social pressures, you will know deep down what you want. And that has to be honored as well. There should not be this kind of thing that, no, if I have to follow my sadhana, I must be single from a mind point of view. Deep down, you must have this answer. And then the fear of making a mistake does not arise, because there truly are no mistakes. It's all a learning experience, you see. And you don't blame the other for the failure. You don't blame yourself for the failure. That is again the gift of the teaching. If there is a failure, and if there is success, you don't pat yourself on the back and you don't praise the other to high heavens, because you know that if this was meant to work out, it is God's will. If it is not meant to work out, even that is God's will. That is how Shwet starts living his life. That is the gift of this teaching. This teaching will not tell you get married or don't get married. This teaching will show you things as they are. That is the beauty of it, you see. Sorry, I can't hear you.
Ultimately, everything is predestined.
Yes, but we can never know what it is that is predestined. So we have to act as if nothing is predestined.
One small question, sir, that should I like to pray to Krishna as well as Shiva, as well as other gods. Is it important that I should focus my attention on one god only?
Not necessary, because all gods are a representation of the one source. If you feel happy doing what you are doing, by all means. But do know that ultimately your focus is on the one, and these are just forms of the one. You see, that is where many people get lost. Many people get lost. In fact, I saw this on a TV serial, a Hindi TV serial the other day. This is a very important point, where this man in a village was famous for making statues of Ganesha. And he was renowned that his entire bhakti went into making the statues. And so the king sends his assistant to this man and says, make me a statue of Krishna. And he refuses. He says, Ganesha is my god. I bow down to no other gods. And every time he tried to make the statue of Krishna, he would end up making a statue of Ganesha, to the extent that he modeled a Ganesha in blue playing the flute. And it was Ganesha who comes and tells him that this is not true bhakti. True bhakti is seeing me in all forms, including Krishna's form. This becomes ahankar, egoic. I am a Ganesha bhakt. I only worship Ganesha, you see. So whatever you like, because in India, the cultural conditioning is such that we are so happy being with Krishna on one side, Ganesha on one side, as long as we know that it is the one consciousness behind all forms, and as long as we know behind all beings in our lives, the ones we like and we don't like, is the same God. That is most important. All right.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes, Abhishek. Abhishek, are you there?
Yeah. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
How are you, sir?
Good. How are you?
Good, sir. Sir, my question is about living in the moment. So let's say there is an enlightened person or a sage, like you mentioned about Nisargadatta Maharaj, that if something is going to happen, and suppose let's say it happens in the moment and anger arises, right? So let's say he shouts or anger arises. So that's one thing. And let's say if the same thing happens with the ordinary person, if again there is his conditioned mind that the anger arises very very frequently, or he shouts very frequently, so how both are so is that the ordinary person is not living in the moment? How is it not? Because still for the ordinary person also something happened and he responded and he shout. So are both of them living in the moment, or it's the enlightened person who is living in the moment and not the other person, ordinary person?
As far as the moment is concerned, there's no one enlightened and unenlightened. Let's be clear about that, right? Now, the difference is that in the sage is the realization. So even when anger arises, that anger that has arisen is not based on doership. It is a biological reaction in the body-mind organism.
Is it not because of the mind?
It is a reaction, a body-mind reaction. It is including the mind. Biological means body-mind. It doesn't mean only body. But the most important point, and this is the whole thing, is that when the sage is established in understanding, that reaction which happens dissolves immediately upon arising. It's forgotten, you can say. It's a movement in consciousness.
So it is not stretched in time, right?
It is not stretched in the duration of time because of the sage's enlightenment or understanding, you can call it. There were angry sages. If you see our rishis in mythology, history, whatever, they used to curse. And one can say, how could a rishi curse?
Right.
But that curse itself set off a series of events which had to happen, you see. That is the thing. The point is that for ordinary people like us, our anger is triggered by and large because we hold people accountable of doing things to us.
Because we know the answer that if this happens, I'll do this. So that means it's our mind which is running.
It's the thinking mind, the ego mind, which gets offended and therefore gets angry. And I spoke about anger in the last Sunday talk quite a bit. You see, that is what happens. If you feel that you don't want your desired outcome, you get angry. If someone challenges your beliefs, you get angry. If someone pushes your buttons, you get angry. That is the egoic reaction. That is not the spontaneous body-mind reaction, which I am referring to that can happen in a sage.
Because that is a preconceived.
I give a common example of what my teacher said, what he saw once in Nisargadatta Maharaj's satsang, that one student who had been coming for a very long time asked a question, and Maharaj told him, anger arose. He said, you've been coming to me for so long and you asked such a stupid question. And he said, Maharaj, what can I do if God made me stupid? And Maharaj burst out laughing. You see, the anger was in the moment, finished.
That the is similar in the case with children as well. So they cry at one moment and next moment they laugh.
Exactly.
Because I think ego is not present there, right?
Yeah, it's not taken full form.
Full form, right.
Ego is there, but it is not hardened by the conditioning which we become, you see. We become these hard balls of conditioning.
But that creation of the conditioning or ego still was not in our hand. And exactly. And the same thing, like whatever I'm asking you a question, or that is predestined because it had to be asked.
Yes.
And if enlightenment has to happen, then if it isn't my destiny, the grace will happen, right?
Yes, because as I said before, you didn't start it. You didn't start
exactly.
The spiritual seek. God started it.
Yes.
But that does not mean that Abhishek should not put in the effort. It doesn't mean he sits back. Because the fire has been kindled, has been lit.
Sir, even if I say I don't make any effort, that's again a doership of not doing anything. Right?
Yes, that is inverted.
Ramesh sir, very beautifully, I was listening to podcast of Ramesh sir, and he beautifully said that try lying on bed and not doing anything. By not doing anything, I mean not even thinking. You won't be able to do that.
Exactly. And he also said, eventually you'll have to get up to go to the bathroom. That's what the ego does. It misinterprets the teaching, you know, and tries to feel, oh, okay. So that means I should not do anything. I should not make any effort.
So that means if we don't take charge, or like if we don't act according to our ego, then also things happen. And it feels like we are doing it, but we are not.
Exactly.
The body and our senses will do the job as is.
Yes.
It's just that we have to meditate on the one God, which is the source, which is the beginning of everything.
And therefore, Abhishek, the most important and overlooked point, if in our daily living we make our peace of mind a criteria, you will find that you will really go pretty far on this journey. Because now you have a measure. Earlier the mind was disturbed, pleasure would come, disturbed, pleasure would come. Now you know, my God, I know now what I am looking for is peace of mind. And then you find the places where peace can be found, even through the most strenuous events in your life. When you just accept this as the divine will, let's say, for example, your father's illness.
Yes, sir, I wanted to discuss that as well. He's battling with cancer, and situation is getting a little out of control. Like, not out of control, it's getting worse because a lot of pain is there. So I am a follower of Shirdi Sai Baba, and I've seen lot of instances, I've read lot of instances where people used to take vows about their family members and they do get healed, right? My point is, I'm not trying to make any such vow, because what best I can do is, like, I can give the medications, I can take him to the doctor, and I'm doing my best, and then I'm making my mind free of anxiety. So am I lacking somewhere? Should I pray, or should I, because I think the state of silence is the best prayer, right? And I'm not doing anything wrong by not praying for this specific thing.
Now, Abhishek, this answer you already have. But you see, supposing you took a vow, as you say, some people take a vow, mannat.
Yes. That
God, if you save so and so, if you do this for me, I will sacrifice this in return, may work. But ultimately, God's will prevails. Is there any guarantee that you take a vow and it will happen the way you want it to happen? Tell me.
No, sir, because I know Baba is still there. He knows everything what is going in my mind, because he resides in me only.
Exactly. Right? Do we really need to tell God what's in our mind?
Exactly. So I think, just wanted to get a clarification from you that the best I'm doing is not running my mind here and there, what will happen next, whether he'll be cured or not, and the anxiety and everything. So I think that way I'm purifying my mind, and that is the biggest prayer I can do, right?
I agree with you, but someone else who believes in vows and in mannats will not agree with us.
Exactly.
That is their journey.
But actually, I'm not telling anyone that I'm not what I'm doing. Like, in the deep down, I understand that I'm just looking for the stillness of the mind. And if my mind is purified and I'm with my dad, then he'll get the same vibration from me as well. So what biggest gift can I give to him at this moment, taking him to the doctor and making my mind still? Because if I am in anxiety mode, then definitely the vibrations from me will be of anxiety to him, right?
Yes, and the greatest gift you can give is your being, just being there for him.
Yes, because if I'm giving the gift of being, that means I'm not running my mind. That means I'm not actually asking for some specific prayer, right?
Exactly. That is, in fact, true prayer. Your gift of being is true prayer, because otherwise it's a begging to God, wanting
exactly.
something from God.
Exactly.
And as you yourself said, God knows everything. God knows best.
He gave he gave this pain to him. And if his will is there, definitely the pain will go.
Yes. You know, I was, I'll tell you something about the Sufi master who I've been referencing. He passed away in 66. He was known for, at that time, smallpox, cholera and all were very big, you know, like pandemics, you could say. And so when someone had their child who was dying from this or really ailing, they would come to him. And he would make these yantras, you know, these geometric diagrams, and he would pray on them and blow on them and fold them and put it in a taviz and say, you put this on the arm or around the neck of the baby and he or she will be fine, right? And so then he was doing this, and sure enough, the child, man or woman who was receiving the yantra was okay. But in some instances, they were not okay. So his disciple asked him that, why is it? I mean, I've seen it that it works because you've saved so many lives, but it doesn't work all the time. And he said, look, I have been given certain powers. Now I tell them that when you wear this yantra, do not remove it, even if you are taking a bath. But he said, I cannot override the divine will, which means if this person is not meant to live, let's say this child, the child's sibling might come in a playful mood and pull out the taviz, and the child will not survive. Because two laws can run simultaneously only up till a point, but ultimately God's will prevails. You see? So that is the highest teaching. Do whatever you want. Take a mannat, don't take a mannat, this, that, left, right, whatever it be. Ultimately, what happens is the will of God.
Yes, Baba himself has said that you have to bear the consequences of a prarabdha. I cannot enter into that, but definitely I can try to reduce or suffering. That means if you try to think about me, then definitely your anxiety and all will go and your suffering will be reduced, right?
And think about me means what? If you abide in your being.
Abide in your being, right. If it is already there.
Being, you are thinking of God as consciousness, being.
Exactly.
All right.
That's take a lot of load off from the thinking mind that what happens, why did I do this, what will happen to me next? Because that is all, I think, garbage, because that won't add any value to your life, because everything will be according to God will. Then why are you actually making your life miserable by thinking all these things?
You said it, Abhishek. I couldn't have put it better.
Thank you, sir. This teaching is helping me a lot. And that's also grace, of course. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes, Pragati.
Namaste, Gautam, sir.
Namaste.
So this is pertaining to the mail that you read. The question arose out of that. I don't know how to polish the question. I'll put it simply. Basically, when we start on the inner journey, we start to look at people differently. We understand them better, see them in a different light. But we also get to see ourselves. We also get to see our egoic side. And I've come to a realization that I am by nature quite a selfish person. And I didn't know that, obviously. I have come to realize after a lot of experiences in the last few years. And I've gone back to people asking them, and they've acknowledged that I've been mean to them. I've been, you know, I've apologized. But the thing is, it still happens. I see it, but it's still happening. It comes out naturally. And people are getting hurt still. And it's something I'm not able to help. How do I stop being selfish?
Well, Pragati, first of all, we all end up hurting people without the intention to. You see, that is something important to realize. And we are not doing it. This does not mean an apology may not arise if someone is hurt. You see? So we can't control this. As you yourself have said, I can't help it. But with the awareness, with the understanding that neither others nor you are doing it, isn't that bringing a relief? And firstly, more importantly rather, we are all selfish. If I am saying that whether you know it or not, you want peace of mind, you're being selfish if you want peace of mind because it is for yourself. If you want to be happy, you are being selfish because you want to be happy. Who is not selfish?
But in the process, others are getting hurt and I know it. I can see it. I don't blame myself for being selfish. I understand that it's naturally coming out of me. But what about the others who are getting affected by my behavior? Should I cut them off so that they don't get hurt? Or what?
See, Pragati, the thing is that if you are immersed in the teaching, and if there's even just acceptance, forget surrender, I'm not sure how, because if doership is removed from the equation, how would you be going around hurting everyone? I can understand in some instances it happens, in some it doesn't. But if by and large everyone is getting hurt, then does it mean what you're trying to say is you still hold them accountable for their actions and therefore you're hurting them? Because this part I don't quite understand.
No, basically I'm available to people when I want to be available. It depends on my mood. You know, I'm that kind of a person who I just cannot give anything if I'm not available.
So what's
emotionally
wrong with that?
Expectations, I guess people have expectations
their
and I'm not able to fulfill them.
Expectations will lead to their frustrations.
The
I think you have to look at this because I don't see this happening actually, frankly, because you know you have been following these teachings for a long while. And if you have come to even an intellectual understanding that whatever happens is God's will, we all instruments of God, including myself, blah, blah, blah. I'm sure that, you know, the way you look at relationships has changed. It cannot not be that. So I don't think you should be too hard on yourself, frankly. I mean, what's the problem if I want downtime and I don't want to be available to everyone all the time? Let them get hurt. And maybe I'm just projecting onto them that they are getting hurt. What's the big deal?
Thank you.
Let life flow like H2O.
Thank you. Okay.
Yes, Vandana.
Hello, Gautam. You started this conversation by quoting from on a satsang. So I just want your comments on the following lines. I'll just read for a minute from Robert Adams. That is, as we sat in silence, what thoughts came into mind? Whatever thoughts there were, good or bad, they've got to go. Even if you're thinking, what a wonderful satsang, that has got to go. All thoughts must go. Your wonderful satsang will not bring you realization. Emptiness will.
Yes. So
how would you like to comment on that?
I think that's beautiful. But I think what he's pointing at is something quite different. What he's pointing at is that in this life of duality, where there'll be wonderful satsangs and not wonderful satsangs, we have to eventually go beyond that, beyond the polaric opposites of duality. That is what he is pointing at, you see. Mm-hmm. So I don't think this has to be taken in a literal sense. Let us not forget, there were scores of devotees of Bhagwan Ramana Maharshi who went to the ashram and stayed with him till the very end. That is satsang. Even if it means living in silence in the vibrational field of the master, that is satsang. What Robert Adams is pointing at is this wonderful satsang. Mm-hmm. Anything which is a crutch, which is at one end, creates the other polaric opposite already. So we have to not be this pendulum which swings from left to right, pleasure and pain, wonderful and not wonderful. And eventually that swing reaches the midpoint of balance, which is peace and equanimity, which is what this whole path delivers. Mm-hmm. That is it. The silence, the stillness of the thinking mind, the stillness within and the silence without.
Okay. Oh, I didn't think of it that way. Thank you.
Okay. We'll take this last. I think Shwet wants to ask a question again. I wonder if it's on his marriage.
No, sir. When you said God's will, I had got a question regarding that. Because when you say God's will, it seems that you are saying that God has a desire. Whereas what I felt that the life situations which I have is due to my past karma rather than God's will. So is there a contraction?
It's neither of the two. God's desire, so to speak, was to know God. to know the singularity became the multiplicity to know itself. That is it. Okay. So when we say the will of God, it means not our individual will. We mean a will which is so vast and comprehensive that we cannot know what it is by our limited mind.
Okay.
So that is, if you project that God has a desire, which means his will, that is because of the way you see your will. You will for something. You will for a beautiful woman, you see. So whether you get one or not is God's will. Which means what? Not that God has a certain desire, means we don't know what will happen.
You said neither of the two. So even karmas,
yes,
don't decide?
Karmas do decide. If we are mired in the karmic battle of life, of action and reaction and consequence, if we are stuck in this loop of karma, then karma decides. But the sage is out of it. The sage is out of this loop. For the sage who has accepted that whatever happens is God's will, karma means only action. It means not action based on doership. This is a very important point which I will go into, and Bhagwan Ramana Maharshi has said something beautiful on it. I will explore this in the next Sunday talk, because this is often misunderstood. Does a sage have karma? A sage has no karma, etc., etc. Because karma can become a very theoretical subject. And that is why my teacher would also say, just forget all this business about karma and focus on your peace of mind in daily living. Right? Okay. So we'll just sit in silence for a few minutes. If any of you all are inclined for our meditations are still going on Thursdays for half an hour from 7 to 7:30, you're welcome to join it. It's a silent meditation where I speak a bit in the beginning. And then if anyone wants to share something related to the meditation, they are welcome to after it. I'm just changing the view so I can see all the wonderful people here and on YouTube. I don't miss them. Shweta, I'll give you some advice. I read this on the net. A wise man once said nothing to his wife because he was a wise man. Bhai Sahib had said, when you look at people, maybe try it today. Try it with your children, maybe your parents, friends. When you look at them with your eyes, of course, look at their eyes, but just that slight switch. Don't look at their physical eyes. As people, either just have this thought, I'm looking at God, consciousness, if that's easier, if God is too difficult to imagine when you're looking at someone, just consciousness, a conscious being. The consciousness which is looking out through these eyes is looking at consciousness through those eyes. Or as one practice was given, look through the eyes of the other person. You can visualize to the back of the head, whatever it may be. But just this subtle shift. I'm looking at a conscious being which I have put labels on. Child, friend, colleague, I like this person, I don't like that person. Just offer your being through your eyes because you're looking at the other person as an expression of the same consciousness. And you will find a sense of neutrality that starts coming in. Something very freeing. Something opens up. You know, if someone has seen death or dead body, let's say, I think this is everyone's experience. And it actually flabbergasted me with Ramesh's dead body. Because I remember that when we took him to the cremation grounds, there was some fault in the system. So we had to wait for 3 hours. And so the body was kept on the stretcher with flowers on it on the side. And we being humans, tired of standing around, went and sat somewhere on chairs and started chatting away. And I thought, isn't this amazing? When he was alive, we all like rats squeezed into a satsang room to listen to each and every word. And when the consciousness has left the body and there's a dead body, nobody wants to be around it because it's dead. So were we really attracted to this body-mind organism called Ramesh or to the being? That being is what we miss when we are interacting with people. That is what happens. But that we know is the truth. Otherwise, stand with the dead body all the time. But we know this deep down, that without the being, that is just a dead body. But when it comes to living this, that is the Maya, that is the illusion.